National Gallery Podcast.
Hello, this is the National Gallery Podcast, and I'm Miranda Hinckley. In this month's show, we shed some light on the history of optical instruments. And what happened to Midas when he got bored with all that gold? But we start with an anniversary. It was 350 years ago this month, on the 6th of August 1660, that the great Spanish painter Diego Velázquez died at the age of 61. Velázquez came from relatively humble stock, but by the end of his life he'd become such an influential figure at court that his funeral was a grand and solemn affair. His rise was largely due to his unique relationship with his lifelong patron, King Philip IV of Spain. To find out more, Leah Caribbean met curator Xavier Bray in front of one of Velázquez's greatest portraits of the king, and she began by asking how Velázquez's life at Philip's court had begun.
He arrived there at the age of 24, so he's very young, but at the same time, you have to remember the king also was very young. He was, I think, if I recall, just 1 year older. So they were pretty much the same age. And Velázquez was given, pretty much through his contacts that he had in Madrid, a sitting to paint a portrait of the king. And he just painted the head. Unfortunately, that's lost. But what we can imagine, it was incredibly focused, but very realistic. And everybody at the court were just amazed by the technique that he had. And he got the job pretty much straight away.
Now, Velázquez rapidly rose through the ranks to become painter to the king, and his job was essentially to paint portraits of the king and the royal family. If you could take us through this astonishing portrait here.
Well, here we have a portrait that he paints a bit later, about sort of 10 years into his career. It's called Portrait Painter, and it shows Philip IV wearing his favourite suit, which is made out of brown and silver thread. So it's an incredibly decorative costume that he's wearing. And you see this figure standing, looking out at you with his left hand on his sword, and then holding a piece of paper. And it's very rigid posture. This is how the king wanted to be portrayed. Earlier portraits show him in exactly the same pose, and later portraits show him also in exactly the same pose. So this was the format that Velázquez had to paint.
Was this a foible of his own, or was this something to do with Spanish court behaviour?
It was very much part of the Spanish etiquette. There's a very strict system at the court of who has access to the king, and it was incredibly rigid. And then the only people who really sort of broke the rules were the dwarfs, and in a way the painters, because the painters had that sort of creativity that allowed them to be different to the rest of the household.
Well, the National Gallery has many fantastic masterpieces by Velázquez, but the one picture I'd like us to go and have a look at next is the king, but at a much later stage in his life. So we're now standing in front of a portrait of King Philip IV, which is just bust height, not a full-length portrait, painted in about 1656. Can you describe it for us?
Well, it's for me, this portrait is as if you were actually witnessing the sitting between Philip IV and Velázquez, because it's so informal. And this is Philip IV, you know, he's old, his skin is sort of sagging almost. He's still pretty much blonde, but you can see sort of wispiness of white hair. But we know from Philip IV, when he wrote to his confessor, this nun, saying that, "I've got to sit for Velázquez again, and I'm almost dreading it. Every time he paints me, he shows me getting older." And it's true that Velázquez almost can't resist to paint what he sees before him. And indeed, a good friend of his, when he saw this portrait, said, "It's so lifelike." And he added, saying, "You know, you can feel the spirit of the man in the portrait." So this is what made Velázquez unique, was in his ability to capture not only the sitter's physiognomy, but the spirit of the person sitting for him.
Now, by this date, Velázquez had become chamberlain to the royal household, very, very elevated position, which left him in charge of all extraordinary things, not only rehanging the court paintings, but also in charge of things like the sheets and...
Velázquez had almost become like a curator, like us lot here at National Gallery, looking after the collection. But he really wanted to be recognised for his incredible talent as a painter. And painters in Spain were generally regarded as craftsmen. And he was trying to break those shackles and make painting a liberal art, like poetry or music. And the only way he really could pull that off was by finally getting a knighthood. And one of the most prestigious knighthoods he could get was the Knight of Santiago. So the way to do it was to petition the king to help him out. The problem is that Velázquez had no noble blood in him, and actually going against him was the fact that he probably had Jewish blood, and that was totally against the rules, that you had to be a pure blood to become a knight. So he spent a long time with trying to pull out papers to prove that he had some kind of noble connection for his mother. But eventually it was thanks to the king and the Pope, Innocent X, whom he'd painted earlier on, who basically intervened and said this man should get the Knight of Santiago for his skills as a painter. And in 1658, he finally gets it.
And so do you think it's because of this very particular relationship with King Philip IV that Velázquez is able to achieve this glory at the end of his career?
I think it is. It's Velázquez, because they grew up together, they developed together, I think they taught each other quite a lot of things. Velázquez discovered the royal collection. Philip IV trusted him with buying pictures and sculpture for the collection. They must have just loved the whole sort of dilettante connoisseurship aspects of collecting. And at the same time, Philip IV gave him incredible opportunities. And he gave basically Velázquez freedom to discover himself. And for me, that's one of the greatest things that one could do, a patron could do. Let him be.
Xavier Bray. You might like to know that the gallery has an extensive collection of works by Velázquez. Leah and Xavier were discussing his two portraits of Philip IV of Spain on display in Room 30. Many of the paintings in the National Gallery are inspired by classical myths and by one work in particular, Ovid's Metamorphosis. Indeed, the 17th century artist, Domenichino, created a cycle of 10 frescoes featuring scenes from the book. We asked storyteller Hugh Lupton to choose one of the paintings and tell us a tale. He selected The Judgment of King Midas, a picture that shows what happened next to King Midas after all that gold.
King Midas was walking deep in a forest, far from his palace, far from the glimmer and the glitter of golden statues and the clink and the chink of golden coins. And as he was walking, he saw in a clearing there was Pan, the god of wild things, the god of wild places. And he was amazed. Pan was playing his pipes. King Midas crouched behind the bushes and he watched and he listened. And Pan was playing and playing and playing his pipes. And then he lowered his pipes from his lips and he began to boast. I'm the finest musician of them all. I'm the finest musician in the world. I'm a finer musician even than golden Apollo when he plucks his golden lyre. Well, nothing is hidden from the ears and the eyes of the mighty gods. And straight away Apollo appeared in the clearing in front of Pan and King Midas, two gods glowering at one another. And Apollo said, Pan, we will have a contest of music, you and I, and the judge will be this mountain. And he gestured to a great mountain called Tmolus that rose up high above the tops of the trees. And as Apollo gestured with his hand, a strange thing. On either side of the mountain, two huge grey stone ears unfolded. And the first to play was Pan. He lifted his pipes to his lips and he blew, and in his music were all the sounds of wild nature. The baying and the belling of stags, the howling of wolves, the pounding of hooves, the creaking of branches, the crashing of floodwater, the humming of bees, the bright songs of birds. It was a music both beautiful and terrifying at the same time. And then Pan lowered his pipes, and it was golden Apollo's turn. He lifted his lyre to his shoulder, and he began to play. And to anyone listening, it was as though the strings of his lyre were the threads of the loom upon which the whole world is woven. Every note was an element, every melody was a formula, and as the shimmering, cascading music came, the whole of creation held its breath. And when Apollo lowered his lyre from his shoulder, the whole world sighed. Pan dropped to his knees and lowered his head, and the great mountain Tmolus opened its cavernous cave of a mouth and pronounced, Apollo is the winner. And then from behind the bushes there came a voice. No. Why should the victory go to golden Apollo? Why should the victory go to the plinkety plonk of a plucked lyre when Pan's music is the real thing? Pan's music is finer by far. It was King Midas. Golden Apollo turned and looked at him and frowned. And with the frown of Apollo, a strange thing. King Midas felt suddenly changed. He lifted his hands to his face and his ears had moved. They were no longer growing out of the sides of his head. They were growing out of the top of his head. Two grey, hairy, twitching, bristling donkey's ears. For one appalling moment, he waited to see if the transformation was going to spread downwards. But no, just his ears. Those ears that had listened and had not heard had been turned into the ears of an ass.
Thanks to Hugh Lupton. Come along to the gallery if you'd like to see The Judgment of King Midas for yourself. It's on display in room 13. And you can also find it and the rest of what are known as the Aldo Brandini frescoes on the website at www.nationalgallery.org.uk. When we think of artists' equipment, it's perhaps of fairly low-tech items like pencils, chalks, brushes and paints. But from the Renaissance to the end of the 19th century, many artists experimented with optical instruments in a bid to more accurately record the world. One of these instruments was known as the camera obscura. To find out more, Leah Caribbean made a special trip to Oxford.
I'm here at the Museum of the History of Science in Oxford with the director, Jim Bennett, to look at some of the museum's fascinating collection of optical instruments. These are all objects of types used right up until the middle of the 19th century by both artists and scientists. And Jim, you've really very kindly got some of these instruments out of their display cases so we can give them a closer look. Some appear a good deal more complicated than others. And could we start off with one of the simpler ones? It's this rectangular box, for instance. It's made of wood and has a lens at one end of it. What is it?
It's called a camera obscura, which just means a dark room, because originally these things really were rooms. You went inside and there was a window, and the lens, which we now see at one end of the box, was in a kind of window, and the projection screen was a wall. So it's a camera obscura, but this is a portable one, one that you could carry around with you. I suppose it's a drawing aid, essentially, but it's also a kind of novelty. It's a kind of object of wonder. Somehow looking at the screen and seeing the scene that's in front of you, perfectly evidently to your eyes, but then somehow in the box, is a curiosity. It makes people surprised.
Now, these boxes, basically, and the rooms themselves, captured an image of the outside world and projected them onto a flat surface. Now, could you tell me how this particular one does that?
Yes, there's a lens at one end, a concave lens, what we call a positive lens, and that's on a tube which moves in and out from the main body of the box.
So it can be focused.
For a focus, just like a camera focus. Mm-hmm. Indeed, these things are the origins of photographic cameras. It's just that the photographic camera does the drawing for you. But in a case like such as this, the light is focused by the lens inside the box and would just fall on the screen in the way that it would do with a camera.
This is beneath a flap.
Yes. In slightly earlier versions, the screen would be vertical here and you would be looking at an upside-down image, just as you would with a plate camera. But in this case, it's a little more advanced in that it's a reflex action, that there's, because there's a mirror at 45 degrees just here, mm-hmm, inside the near end of the box, which reflects the image up onto this ground glass screen and also means that you're looking at it the right way up.
Now, I have a piece of tracing paper here and a pencil, and if I were to put these bits of paper actually on the screen, I'm a bit perplexed because I'm not seeing an awful lot on the ground glass screen in order to do my tracing. What's going wrong?
The problem here is we don't have enough light. Really, these things work best outside. And I can imagine that at the time that they were common, when there wasn't even electric light, it was oil lamp or candle or something, they'd be a bit sort of underwhelming as far as we're concerned. They wouldn't give you a very bright image at all. In fact, as you said, we're struggling to see anything in this one. But if we take it outside, I think we'd have a very different effect.
Now, looking at this box, which obviously can be carried, yes, by hand, this seems fairly handy for taking out of doors, perhaps, and recording a landscape, but still not necessarily that easy to balance on one knee, or, you know, you'd have to rest it on something. Oh. But other camera obscura were incredibly bulky.
Yes. Yes, some were smaller. I mean, we have an 18th century one, which we can't show you today because it's on loan, which is much smaller than this. So it's almost a pocket-sized one. So they come in a whole range. As you know, there are also some that are architectural. They're built into the building, and you go into a room, and those ones are still operating off as public spectacles. But yes, in between those two, there are quite bulky ones that perhaps come in a tent, or you set them up in it with a tripod, and there's a tent. The camera lens is in at the apex of the tent, and you creep inside, and you're able to sit down, and you perhaps have a little writing desk or drawing desk for drawing on. So they can be very, very elaborate.
But did it have any other use other than for people who are interested in capturing images for artistic purposes?
It depends what you mean by use. It's a sort of magic to it, in that, after all, a picture is something you carry into a room, you hang it on the wall, and there it is. You take it off again, you carry it out if you want to have a succession of them. This makes pictures appear out of nothing on the wall, and then they disappear again out of nothing. So, and these objects are partly in that tradition. They play on the wonders that can be achieved by optics. But they certainly appear in my world, in the 18th century, say, in books about the wonders that can be achieved with all sorts of natural means, like cogs and wheels and clocks and machines and also and automata and so on. So it's very much in that world for me rather than in the world of the artist.
And finally, you've got a very beautiful advert in the museum archives for a fixed camera obscura, one that you could walk inside, that was built in Southport in the late 19th century. And it still has the words natural magic written as part of the attraction. That seems marvellous to me, actually.
That's part of the appeal. In fact, as I was putting things together for your visit, I was thinking we should do an exhibition on natural magic, because I'm sure the appeal is still there.
Wonderful. Thank you very much indeed.
Thanks to Jim Bennett, Director of the Museum of the History of Science in Oxford. That's it for this episode. If you're visiting, don't forget the National Gallery is open 10 till 6 daily and 10 till 9 on Fridays. You can find information about any of the works in the collection, including where to find them, at www.nationalgallery.org.uk, along with up-to-date news of all our exhibitions and events. Till next month, goodbye.